IPv6 no longer optional. I think that's pretty self-explanatory, but in case you missed the memo, this is what the IPv4 free pool looks like today. The red line is the global free pool. You'll notice that it's pretty well gone. The other little, kind of spiky lines floating along near zero are the size of the various RIR free pools, and you notice that just to the right of that green arrow, they're converging on a zero point as well. So, as a matter of fact, APNIC reached zero. Now, the interesting thing about this slide is that you see that blue line that shows 100% probability that APNIC will run out, maybe in April? That slide is the April 17th version of the slide. Jeff's graph on April 15th and before showed that somewhere out towards June of 2011, maybe July, August, in kind of a bell shape. But APNIC actually ran out on April 15th. So I sent Jeff an email asking for an updated version of the graph, and he sent me the same graph, and I pointed out that, I thought that the blue line needed to move to the left a little bit, and he went, oops, yeah, okay, and he fixed the graph. So we're not very good at predicting this stuff. These are my current sort of guesses, and they are just that. If anything, I suspect those dates will come in closer to now. The one exception is RIPE. Obviously, RIPE is going to be later than November because they didn't run out yet. But they're down to less than 2/8s at this point. It's been a little while since I updated this slide. But IANA ran out in February. The Regional Internet Registry started running out in April of this year. April 15th, APNIC ran out. End user providers started running out shortly after RIR run out, and most likely the larger ones like APNIC will happen first. Obviously they did. RIPE will probably be the next one to run out, and ARIN will probably follow suit. My best guess on ARIN at this point is somewhere around the end of next year. So if you need IPv4 addresses, I don't want to send you to a run on the bank, but do be aware that the teller windows will be closing. After ISP start running out, an increasing number of the people coming to you, the websites that you administer and other such things, are going to have limited or seriously degraded ability to get there on IPv4. So the better you are at providing IPv6 services to them, the more likely you are to provide them a good user experience. So how ready are we for this IPv6 thing that everybody keeps talking about? Well, there are some things that are mostly ready. Most of the larger backbones actually, if you push them hard enough, can do some V6 thing for you. Most of the cable modem systems that are running DOCSIS 3 actually can support IPv6 once the provider gets around to figuring out how to do it. Mac OS has had IPv6 support since about 10.4 that's been basically functional. 10.7 actually is a pretty substantial improvement in the OSX IPv6 stack. Unfortunately, it comes with some other baggage, but that's the way OS upgrades go. Linux, all of the 2.6 kernels pretty well work on IPv6. Windows 7 and Server 2008 and even everything since XP has some IPv6 support. The problem with XP is that XP can't resolve names over IPv6. It does everything else mostly just fine, but it will not talk to a name resolver over IPv6. It'll accept V6 records from the name resolver, but it won't talk to it on IPv6. So you have to have a V4 connection to your name resolver if you're running XP. WiMAX, the specification and the head end equipment is mostly there. LTE has mostly support for IPv6. Customer premise equipment is limited, but there is some available. Lots of early adopters and some industry experts. Hurricane Electric obviously is completely dual stack everywhere. We're running native V6 all over our backbone and on all our routers and even on most of our office networks. And of course, I've got V6 running at home and everywhere else. Things that aren't ready. Most of the passive optical network systems, those of you that have Fios, et cetera, are not quite there yet. Actually, Verizon has made a lot of progress over the last few months, and a lot of the Verizon Fios actually does have IPv6 capability now. DSL systems, way behind, partially because the Broadband Forum didn't get around to deciding how to do V6 over DSL until October of last year when they finally published the first spec. DOCSIS 2 systems, some of the cable companies are still running some of these legacy DOCSIS 2 systems. They're likely not going to do IPv6. WDS, EVDO, HSPA, fortunately we're moving off of that for the most part. Most of the WiMAX handsets, even though the WiMAX protocol and all of the head-end equipment is mostly capable of IPv6, most of the handset builders, this means you HTC if you're listening, have not figured out that V6 is important yet. Older versions of Windows, a lot of embedded systems. Any of you running SCADA networks, you're going to have an uphill battle there. Printers, very, very few printers, though some are starting to support V6. I now have an HP 8500 all-in-one at home that does a very nice job of doing everything it does on IPv6 as well as V4. Home entertainment devices, customer electronics. We harped on that a little bit in Richard's session yesterday. These are the vendors we really need to be pushing right now because they're kind of holding up everybody else. Most customer premise equipment, not quite ready yet, and obviously a lot of IT staff and management, not quite there yet. So, how many of you have started planning IPv6 within your organization? Quick show of hands. Okay, more hands than we were getting 6 months ago. How many of you have it running in a test environment at least? Okay, actually most of the hands, that's good. How many of you have started deploying IPv6 to your broader organization? Okay, that eliminated a few, but that's still a pretty good showing. And how many of you have a fully production dual stack network throughout your organization? Hey, we've got a couple of hands, that's good. We need to get everybody to that point. That's where we kind of need to be before IPv4 runs out. The bad news is IPv4 has already run out in Asia, so we're behind the times. So in a lot of the other rooms where I've asked this question, on average I get about 5% planning, about 2% with a test environment, one to two hands deploying, and usually I'm the only person who can raise his hand for full production. So we're doing better than the average in this room. That's a good sign. If you're not planning, you need to be asking yourself why, because this is going to hit you like an oncoming train if you don't have a plan at least. If you're already deploying, great, keep moving, let us know how we can help. If you're in full production, start helping your neighbors. We're all in this together. This is really one of those situations where a rising tide can float all boats and a tsunami can sink us all. So it behooves us to actually help our competitors out and help other people out in getting this migration done, because we're all kind of in this together and we want a functional internet moving forward that can keep growing. And this is just kind of my editorial statement about NAT. I'll let it speak for itself. You know, one of the nice things about V6 is we don't have to do NAT anymore. I hear a lot of people look at the problem and say, I don't need IPv6. I have plenty of IPv4 addresses for many years to come. Well, that's not exactly the right way to look at this. You're not on the internet to talk just to your own organization, right? You're using IP addresses because you want to talk to the rest of the world. The rest of the world is running out of IPv4 addresses. You're not going to hand them your addresses, or even if you do, that isn't going to be enough. So you got to recognize that the rest of the world is going to be forced to move forward to IPv6, and the internet's going to move on without you if you don't move with it. So there simply aren't enough IPv4 addresses for everybody that needs to be on the internet. And all of the workarounds that people have proposed, carrier grade, NAT, NAT 4.6, NAT 6.4, IVI, they all come with some really, really nasty trade-offs, and they break things, and they break different things in different ways. Anybody who's developed software for NAT traversal in home gateways understands that NAT is just a nightmare to cope with. Well, when you move that out of the home gateway or add an additional layer of it at the carrier level, it gets even worse. So the real questions we have to be asking ourselves, and I'm not looking for answers from you guys right now, but these are things that people really need to be thinking about organizationally, is my organization going to be IPv6 ready by February of next year? What do you plan to do to fix that if the answer is no? And how do you plan to cope with a world where there are no more IPv4 addresses available? Because we are rapidly closing in on that day. How do you plan to cope with a world where some of your customers only have IPv6 connectivity, or at best, they have severely degraded IPv4 connectivity? And really, it boils down to two possible choices. Either you deploy dual stack and you join this lady at the beach, or you join this fellow out in the African outback and act like an ostrich. We just need more NAT. IPv4 is fine. So beyond this, I'm going to actually start getting into more of the how-to because the why I think I've dwelled on enough. And we're going to cover some of the basics of IPv6, how IPv6 addresses are doled out, and how to configure IPv6 on Linux, and what you can do if you can't get a native backbone readily available, and how to get IPv6 for free because people like free stuff. We'll also talk a little bit about routing, firewalls, DNS, reverse DNS, troubleshooting, and staff training. So the first thing is IPv6 requires a certain amount of a paradigm shift because we're moving from a realm of scarcity to a realm of inconceivable abundance, okay? Once you get past about 1 million, the human brain just says large number, larger, large number, larger, larger, large number. And by the time you get to 340 undecillion, it's just like there's no way to wrap your head around the concept. So what we need to do is we need to realize that it's a different addressing paradigm and we need to look at different ways to optimize things. IPv4, we had 3.7 billion total unicast addresses. And that, by the way, includes the RFC 1918 stuff and some others. In IPv6, we have 42 undecillion IPv6 addresses that are assignable out of the current 1/8 of the address space that the IETF has designated for global unicast. Okay, we still have 7/8 of the address space left that we can expand into if we fill up this 1/8 anytime soon. 42 undecillion is 42 followed by 36 zeros, for those of you that don't want to try and do that math in your head this early in the morning. In IPv4, the most prevalent network size kind of generally is the /24, or what people used to call a Class C network. And that's it'll accommodate 254 hosts plus a broadcast and an unknown address. Okay. In IPv6, we don't count hosts. You just don't bother, because you assign every subnet a /64 and move on. Okay. How many hosts can a 64 hold? The simple answer is all of them. All of the hosts you want to put on any given subnet will fit within a /64. Okay. As a thought exercise, think about building a reverse zone file and mapping out an entire /64. There isn't enough disk space on the planet to hold the necessary swap file. Okay, it's that big. There's 18 quintillion addresses in a /64. You don't need to worry about counting how many hosts you're going to put on the network, and you don't need to worry about the network outgrowing its prefix, which is a good thing. Notation is a little bit different. I'm pretty sure everybody in this room understands hexadecimal and can switch between dots and colons without too much difficulty, so I won't dwell on that. Very important thing when you're shortening IPv6 addresses, especially when you're doing it in software, you can only have one set of double colons in an address. If you put two sets of double colons, it's impossible to tell how many zeros belong in which one. And when replacing consecutive fields full of zeros with double colons, there are some decisions to make about where to do that. Usually the ideal place is as close as possible to the 64 boundary between the prefix and the suffix, but that's less relevant. But what that means is that when you're going to compare IPv6 addresses, you either want to convert them to binary and then do the comparison in binary, or you want to store them as fully elongated text strings and do the comparison in the fully elongated version of the text string with all the zeros put back in it rather than in the user-readable short form, because the short form may not match, because you may have two different automated processes shorten it in two different ways, or you may have an automated process and a user shorten it in different places. So in terms of doing a size comparison between V4 and V6, so far, this is the closest I've been able to come to helping people wrap their head around the size of this stuff. An average bag, large bag of almond M&Ms is 254 M&Ms, so we'll sort of say that's roughly equivalent to a Class C. Now, if we empty the enough bags of M&Ms out onto the football field such that one M&M represents every Class C in IPv4 global unicast, we have enough M&Ms to actually make a single layer of M&Ms, one M&M deep, over 70 yards of an American regulation NFL football field. Okay? Only the first 70 yards. On the other hand, if we take the number of M&Ms in a slash 64 and we pour that into the Great Lakes, we literally fill them to the rim, all five of the Great Lakes. Okay? It's that many more addresses. And it turns out that there are enough slash 64s that if we use an M&M to represent each of the slash 64s in IPv6, we can still fill the Great Lakes. So imagine the Great Lakes full of M&Ms squared. That's how many addresses we're dealing with in IPv6. So this leads to needing to think a little bit differently. In IPv4, the assignment unit was the slash 32. We went, how many hosts do I need? Okay, I'll make the network that big. Okay, if I need 8 hosts, I have to give it a 28 because 8 hosts don't fit in a 29, but God, I really hate to waste those other addresses. Okay, in IPv6, we don't count hosts. We just assign a 64 to the subnet, and we know that everything's going to fit. So in IPv4, we were constantly having to manage these trade-offs in address assignment policy between aggregation of prefixes and scarcity of addresses. And that's how we ended up with a 400,000 route table, which is not good for the average router and creates lots of churn and other problems. In terms of address optimization, in IPv6, aggregation is number one. Okay? At least for this first 1/8 of the address space, we can afford to focus on aggregation, be very liberal in what we hand out, and not so stingy, and optimize in some different ways. In IPv4, we handed out addresses based on kind of a sequential allocation process using a slow start methodology, and we ended up with frequent fragmentation as a result. In IPv6, we can actually do this thing called allocation by bisection, where we kind of go, you know, what's the biggest chunk of free space I've got? Okay, I'll put this kind of in the middle of it. And then when we need another network, we can do that. And by doing that, we usually end up with lots of big holes stretching beyond the addresses that we've allocated. And we can quite often expand those prefixes by just moving bits to the left and leaving the numbers in place, which means we don't have to renumber stuff, but we can still preserve aggregation as things grow. In IPv4, we had to conserve addresses. We were so desperate to conserve addresses that we damaged the network's functionality. We got rid of the end-to-end principle. We eliminated the ability to treat everything as a peer. And we did this really funky hack that people love to hate and love to love, and depends on where your passions lie, called NAT. Not mostly supported in IPv6, although there is some support emerging because people just can't get rid of their IPv4 thing. Address configuration, two options in IPv4, static and DHCP. IPv6, we have both of those, but we also have a third option called stateless auto configuration. We'll talk more about that in a minute. So v6 clients talking to v4 only servers kind of looks like this. Not a new lossy compression algorithm, just not a lot of communication. Address scopes are kind of a new thing in IPv6. There's currently two. There's global unicast and site local. I'm sorry, link local. Site local was deprecated. Link local addresses are only valid on a given link. They are unique to the link. A link is different from a subnet. A link is essentially a layer 2 network boundary, but you may have more than one layer 3 network on a given link. So the link local addresses talk to everything on the link, whether it shares the same layer 3 subnets for the global unicast or not. Site local was deprecated. The replacement for it is not a scoped address, but a perverted form of global unicast called unique local addresses, which are essentially the IPv6 equivalent to RFC 1918. And then global unicast is currently coming out of 2000/3, and it's pretty much everything else. It's the kind of addresses you're used to working with in V4. Stateless auto configuration is the easiest way to put IPv6 on an interface because all you have to do is turn the machine on and it works. It provides only the prefix and router information. There are now extensions to it to get DNS server information, finally, but they're not widely implemented yet on the client side. It does have one little kind of annoying characteristic in that it assumes all advertising routers are created equal modulo the priority bits set in the router advertisement, which are limited to high, medium, or low. And a rogue RA can be pretty transparent to the end user. Unlike a rogue DHCP server, you can build a rogue router that actually doesn't break the network and can operate very transparently, sniffing your packets. The solution to this is RAGuard. So if you're buying switches or wireless access points, it is very important that you insist on your vendors having RAGuard before you purchase. Compared to a rogue DHCP, an accidental rogue RA might break some stuff, is relatively easy to find and pretty easy to mitigate. Unfortunately, a malicious rogue router advertiser can actually be virtually undetectable because what he does is he says, hey, I'm the best router on this network. All your packets, send those to me and I'll get them to the internet. He can still hear the other routers on the internet advertising their, on the local network, advertising their RAs. So he can forward all of those packets that he collects to those routers, and the only noticeable side effect is a couple of additional milliseconds of delay. So you don't necessarily even see him, and in fact, you may not. He may not even show up in a traceroute. The traceroute, if he doesn't decrement the TTL, is going to show the legitimate router, not this rogue. So you're not even going to know you're sending your packets to him. He doesn't break anything, okay? But he can sniff everything, and that's just not good. The way that stateless autoconf works is your host wakes up, it takes its MAC address, converts it to 64 bits, and I won't go into the details, it's pretty straightforward, and it says, I'm going to use this link local address. Anybody object? And it listens for a little while, and if nobody objects, it says, great, I'm unique, and it moves on. If somebody objects, if somebody says, hey, that's my address, then it shuts down V6 on the interface, and until you manually intervene, you're not going to get V6 running on that interface. This is actually better than what we currently get with V4, where they sit there and they fight over who gets to use which MAC address, and the switch goes, and you know, bad stuff happens. Once they get their link local address figured out, they send an ICMP6 router solicitation to the All Routers Multicast group. The routers send back a unicast ICMP6 router advertisement to the link local unicast address of the host in response. Routers that are doing router advertisements also will periodically send out a multicast packet router advertisement to all hosts, and that allows the hosts to refresh their timers for these stateless auto-configured addresses. The router advertisement will include a list of prefixes, a preference, and for each prefix, a desired lifetime and a valid lifetime. Every time a host receives one of these router advertisements, it takes the desired and valid lifetime values out of the router advertisement and resets the timers to those values. So if you make a mistake, if you have a router come up and start advertising the wrong prefix on a network, and you need to correct that right away, you can actually correct that much faster by sending out router advertisements with a lifetime of zero, which will cause the host to instantly deprecate those addresses rather than just turning off the router advertisement, which will actually cause the host to wait until the timers count down to zero and then deprecate the addresses. So you can actually send out poison RAs to immediately deprecate addresses. It's kind of a nice feature. Also allows for some bad things to happen. Everything's a trade-off. Once the desired lifetime expires, here's why we have two counters. The desired lifetimer, once it expires, the host will no longer initiate new connections using that as a source address. The address remains valid on the interface, existing flows are allowed to continue, and traffic coming into the host can create new sessions using that address, but the host will no longer initiate new sessions from that address. Okay? Once the valid lifetimer expires, the address is actually deprecated, removed from the interface, any flows using that address are terminated. This allows for graceful renumbering because you can set up an RA that starts advertising the new prefix and stops advertising the old prefix. The desired lifetimer, let's say that runs for another hour or so, and then the host stops using that address to create new connections. So you know that within an hour, nobody is initiating new sessions using that old deprecated address. Probably you want to set your valid lifetimer for a day or maybe even 2 days later. So when those expire, then you know that within 2 days, every host has deprecated that address completely, and you're now safe to remove that address from the router interface, and you've completed your renumbering task for that subnet. And the users mostly didn't even notice because very few people maintain sessions across multiple days, and even the ones that do expect those to occasionally get disrupted for a variety of reasons. DHCP v6, a lot like DHCP v4, but different in some very meaningful ways. So if you're going to be using DHCP to allocate v6 in your environment, you will want to do some serious studying about it before you start your deployment. It can assign prefix lengths other than /64. Ideally, you want to use this for what's called prefix delegation, where you're actually handing a router, here's a 48. You can actually subdivide that as you wish. So that's a new feature in IPv6 where we can actually use DHCP to hand out large blocks of network numbers to routers that can then automatically further dole out hierarchies, and we can build multiple layers of automated topology. It can assign addresses to hosts. It cannot provide any routing information as it currently stands. Slack lacked DNS, DHCP lacked routers. This basically boils down to a religious holy war in the IETF that didn't benefit anybody. It can provide additional information about servers, DNS, boot file, NTP, etc. Vendor support still lacking in some areas. macOS did not have DHCP client or server capabilities for v6 until Lion. So if you're going to be using DHCP, all your Macs have to go to Lion. Static addressing works the same in v6 as it did in v4. There are a couple of rules you want to observe that are a little odd. The prefix and the first 12 bits of the 64-bit, the prefix can be whatever. The first 12 bits of the host address, though, have to be zero for a static address. Otherwise, you risk conflicting with the auto-configured addresses. Quite commonly, when you're doing an IPv4 overlay network, you're going to want to use the same host number, either in binary coded decimal or in converting it to hex, as your host address in v6. And there's nothing wrong with doing that. As long as the first 12 bits remain zero, they won't conflict with the IPv6 auto-configured addresses. Privacy addresses are a pathological form of stateless autoconf. They use a new suffix periodically or for each flow or depending on how the vendor chose to implement it, some other metric for when they change. Microsoft, in their infinite inability to read RFCs, decided that the network suffix should change whenever you move to a new network, but that when you come back to the same network, it should stay the same. That's actually kind of useful, but if you care about the details of how this is supposed to be implemented, it's RFC 3041. It's actually a relatively plain text, plain English RFC. It's fairly easy to follow as RFCs go. It uses an MD5 hash with a random component to generate a temporary address. The preferred and valid lifetimes are still derived from the router advertisement that you get with the Slack process. And unfortunately, it has become the default way that addressing works in Lion and Vista and other operating systems. Linux is still clinging to the idea that obfuscating addresses is bad. Hopefully, Windows and Apple will renege and realize that it is bad. But for the time being, it is the default. So you need to be aware of that as that impacts your environment. Multiple addresses per interface, kind of uncommon in IPv4, but it did occasionally happen. It's utterly required in IPv6. There's no such thing even as the concept of a primary or secondary address in IPv6. All addresses on an interface are treated relatively equally. And in fact, you can't have a functional IPv6 environment with only one address on the interface, because as a minimum, you need a link local and a global unicast address to do anything other than talk to your local network. You can't have global unicast without link local. It just doesn't work in v6. IPsec in IPv4, IPsec was an add-on kind of hack, and it was kind of poorly implemented. In IPv6, it's a required part of any IPv6 stack. That doesn't mean all the stacks have it. It just means that the ones that don't aren't RFC compliant. You don't have to use it if you don't want to, contrary to some of the FUD that's out there about IPv6. It is considerably easier to use IPsec in IPv6 than it was in IPv4. And it's actually possible that we'll be able to use opportunistic encryption for IPv6 IPsec in the future. And in fact, there is a product called Direct Connect that actually does do that. Configuring IPv6 native on Linux depends on your distro. If you're in Debian or one of the Debioids, you're using ETSI interfaces or ETSI network interfaces, depending on which version. Red Hat distros, Red Hat Enterprise, Fedora, CentOS, etc., use ETSI sysconfig network scripts, blah, blah, blah. The interfaces file ends up looking like this. You're all familiar with the IPv4. IPv6 static, pretty much the same as IPv4, just with different addresses. The good news is we don't make you write out the netmask in IPv6. You can simply say netmask 64 for a /64, which is good because typing out FFFF:FFFF:FFFFF:FFFFF:0000:0000 gets old really fast. The easiest way to configure v6 is simply iface eth1 inet6 auto. That'll turn on stateless autoconf and you're done. So that's another option. The Red Hat version looks like this. The IPv6 adder underscore secondaries is kind of an unfortunate name for the variable because these addresses are in no way secondary. They're just additional addresses on the interface. They're treated equally. So I suspect that they needed to name the variable something. Nobody could come up with a good name, and whoever wrote the script used to work for Cisco. IPv6 autoconf, even easier. IPv6 init equals yes. IPv6 autoconf equals yes, and you're done. So what happens if you're ready for IPv6, but your ISP isn't? Well, generally, it's kind of hard to make the internet work if your ISP won't pass the packets. So what we need to do is we need to work around that. And the easiest way to work around that is we take v6, wrap it up in v4, send it across the area that doesn't understand v6 to some part of the v6 internet that does understand v6, unwrap it there, and pass it along. This is called tunneling. There's three options for tunneling, and in order of preference, there's 6-in-4, 6-2-4, and Teredo. The advantage of 6-in-4, and you can actually use GRE as well as 6-in-4 for this, the primary differences between them are that 6-in-4 uses protocol 41 and GRE uses protocol 43. GRE is pretty well understood by most network administrators. Most of us understand how to deal with GRE tunnels. They're simple, they're deterministic. You've got a defined endpoint here, a defined endpoint there. If you're not the administrator at both ends, you know who the administrator at the other end is. And you can talk to them, and you can debug it together. And it's very, very simple and straightforward to figure out whether the packets are flowing or not and why they're not if they aren't. 6-to-4, on the other hand, still uses protocol 41, but it uses some Anycast magic and some other weirdness to kind of make everything automatic. When it works, it's really nice. It works really well. The problem is it works about 65% of the time, which is not so good. And when it doesn't work, it's non-deterministic. It's a Heisen bug. You have to like send a lot of packets and figure out, okay, these packets are getting through, but these packets aren't. Where are the packets that aren't getting through going? and kind of trace that down. And anything that changes anywhere on the internet can modify the test environment that you're trying to debug. So it's really not fun to debug. It might be a good option for certain kinds of mobile devices, laptops, cell phones, et cetera, if they don't have a better way to get to the V6 internet for the time being. But again, the big disadvantage is because it uses Anycast to determine the endpoints and it makes independent Anycast decisions at each end of the tunnel, it's very non-deterministic and very, very hard to troubleshoot. Teredo. All the fun of 6-4 with some additional Microsoft magic thrown in, and it runs over UDP, so it provides bi-directional IPv6 routing that will get through your NAT and your firewall whether you want it to or not. That's always good. If you really care about implementing this, there is a Linux implementation called Moredo that will do both the client and the server. This is every bit as complicated and tricky to troubleshoot as 6.2.4, and then it has some additional, you know, Microsoft trickiness thrown in on top of it. So configuring a 6 and 4 tunnel on Linux, not as straightforward as you would hope. There is help available on how to do this at tunnelbroker.net. If you're running a fairly recent kernel, these are the actual commands that need to get executed, but putting it in the config files is a little bit trickier. Debian has recently added support for tunnels in their config files. I don't yet have an example of that, I apologize. I don't do a lot of Debian work, so I haven't had time to put that in a lab. NetTools, if you're running a really old kernel, these are the commands that have to happen. Nothing running this old of a kernel has support for tunnels in the config files. Fedora 12 and later, you can actually do it in the config files, but you have to configure not only the interface config file, you also have to modify etc sysconfig network, and you have to add the static route thing here, and you have to add the route 6-sit1 file there. But the good news is, yes, indeed, you can get IPv6 for free. There are a number of tunnel brokers out there for probably somewhat obvious reasons. My personal favorite is the Hurricane Electric Tunnel Broker at www.tunnelbroker.net. There's also some IPv6 online training available there, and if you manage to get yourself all the way to our SAGE level of certification, we'll send you a free t-shirt. So hopefully that motivates you a little bit. You know, you laugh when I say hopefully that motivates you a little bit, but we actually managed to triple the size of the IPv6 network at the time when we first announced the t-shirt program. If your organization has a presence at an exchange point where Hurricane Electric is also present, we will offer you free IPv6 transit across the exchange point if we peer with you. And if you want to peer with us, just send an email to me or to peering@he.net. We have a one-word peering policy that is rather unusual in the industry. That word is yes. We'll peer with anybody. In terms of routing, you've got the usual suspects. OSPF becomes OSPF3. If you really, really like OSI-style Arcana, you can use ISIS with IPv6 as well. BGP uses BGP4 with address family INET6. And you have, of course, router advertisement. The open source implementation of router advertisement is rather unfortunately named RADVD. And there is support for routing V6 in Quagga and others. In case you're familiar with IP tables, and that's how you do your filtration in IPv4, you will see that this looks very familiar. IP6 tables, just like IPv4 tables, with bigger, longer addresses. DNS, forward DNS is pretty straightforward. It's just like IPv4, except instead of A records, we use quad A records, because the addresses are 4 times as big. And the right side is a DNS, is an IPv6 address instead of an IPv4 address. Reverse DNS, a little bit more complicated. Instead of inadder.arpa, we use ip6.arpa. And you have to put the zeros back in before you reverse the address. Trust me, reversing the address and then putting the zeros back is a route to pain. I've tried this experiment. Don't ask me why. And you eventually end up with something that looks like that nice long string at the bottom. So one of the side effects of IPv6 is that your reverse DNS zone files will end up using a very, very small font. The, The current version of Bind ships with IPv6 template zones already built in, hence RFC 1912, et cetera. IPv6 addresses are valid in all of the Bind configuration files and ACLs, et cetera. Every place you could put an IPv4 address, you can type an IPv6 address, and it just works. Zone configuration is identical except for the reverse zones being called IP6.ARPA instead of inadder.ARPA. So, for example, this is an actual excerpt from my nameD.conf file that runs my house, and that's the reverse zone for my /48. Dollar origin is very much your friend in IPv6 reverse zones. It allows you to go back to a readable sized font. Forward zones, IPv4 A's and quad A's can live right next to each other. For example, this is a dual stack host, actually exists in the real world. If you do a host command of that, you'll see both of those addresses returned. Reverse zone PTR records, exactly as described above. Notice here that dollar origin saves all of that typing, and all I have to do is put the last four digits in to each host address, and that helps a lot because you'll notice that while the font here is small, these are actually reasonable sized and you can read them. Each entry contains the four hex digits of the last quad. Each nibble is a zone boundary. So instead of having to have, 256 things in a zone, we're down to 16 things in a zone if you want to do it that way. The most common thing that people do is they don't put enough zeros in, or they leave out a dot, or they put the zeros in the wrong place because they reversed the address first and then tried to put the zeros back in. Troubleshooting, it's mostly the same as troubleshooting IPv4. The same kinds of things go wrong. Start at layer one and work up, just like you do in IPv4. And in fact, if you're more familiar with IPv4, and you're trying to troubleshoot a problem that might be at layers 1 and 2, you can use IPv4 to troubleshoot that in most cases. If the IPv4 layer 1 and 2 stuff works, chances are the layer 2 1 and 2 stuff works for IPv6 also. There are some exceptions to that. There are some broken switches that go, oh, I don't recognize that ether type, I'm going to drop it. It's time to replace the switch when you encounter that, by the way. So common problems, stuff doesn't get through, you can't reach the IPv6 internet, long waits for IPv6-enabled websites, long delays in host resolution. If you can't ping something, then it pretty much means that the packets aren't getting through somewhere and you need to troubleshoot layers 1 and 2 and work your way up. If you can't reach the IPv6 internet, for example, you go to www.foo.com, which is an IPv6-enabled website, and it waits and it waits and it waits, and then it loads fast. Well, that is a pretty clear symptom that what's happening is you're timing out trying to reach it on V6 and then falling back to V4. And as soon as you fall back to V4, it works. So that's an indication that your V6 connectivity to that site is broken, and that's why you're timing out. Long delays in host resolution are another symptom of broken V6 where your computer expects V6 to be working. Why don't my IPv6 neighbors show up in ARP? I get this all the time. I did an ARP-A and none of my V6 neighbors show up. Of course they don't. V6 doesn't use ARP, it uses neighbor discovery. So there are no broadcasts in V6, although I'm not sure how one distinguishes the all hosts multicast group from the broadcast group of hosts. This is one of the key differences in IPv6 though. In IPv4 we had ARP and then an address, and we got back the MAC address. In IPv6, it's a little bit more complicated. We do IP-FINET6 neighbor show, and then the V6 address, and we'll get the equivalent. But the IP command seems to be unique to Linux. I don't know what the equivalent is on BSD. I apologize for that. You also need to be aware that if you want to ping something on many operating systems, you have to use ping 6 to send it to a V6 address. Traceroute, often you need to use Traceroute 6. On the other hand, Telnet, SSH, WGET, et cetera, seem to just work with both addresses. There is a cool trick you can do with SSH. If you have a V4 host here and a V6 host there and a dual stack host that you have access to in the middle, you can actually use that dual stack host as a proxy using an SSH tunnel to translate your v4 TCP over here to v6 TCP over there. And this is how to do it. It's on the slides, which are on your USB sticks, so I won't dwell on the how-tos. One of the key messages you need to take back with you from this talk is that you're going to need to allow for staff training to deal with this v6 stuff. Your people are going to have to be able to wrap their heads around this. Hopefully this presentation helped a little bit. You're going to need quite a bit more. You're going to need to plan for it, you're going to need to budget for it, and you're going to need to allocate time for it. So plan accordingly. And if at all possible, please take away the electronic leashes from your staff before they go into training, because they are a serious distraction, not only to the staff member in training, but to the other people in the class. And with that, I think we have a limited amount of time for questions, because I'm actually slightly over what David told me to do. Any questions? Comments? Rotten fruit? Everybody's asleep. If you can come to the mic, because we are streaming this session. It's a race. Run.
How do you get provisioning for IPv6 these days? I mean, how common is it to get it up there, and what kind of subnets do they hand out when you go forth hat in hand saying, please may I have a subnet?
Well, so it depends on what level you're talking about this. If you're talking about, you know, I need a single subnet within my organization and I'm going to the organizational hostmaster, then the answer is that's very organization dependent, but the hostmaster should give you at least a 64 for a single subnet. If you're talking about my organization wants to go to my ISP, mm-hmm. Well, in that case, the ISP should give you at least a 48 per site.
Okay.
If you're talking about I'm an ISP and I'm going to the local regional internet registry, or I'm a multi-homed organization and I'm going to the local regional internet registry, for a multi-homed end organization, they should get at least a 48 per site from the regional internet registry. For the ISP, they should get at least a 32.
All right.
Which, you know, in IPv4, a 32 isn't a lot of addresses. It turns out in IPv6, it's quite a few. It's 65,536/48s, which can support 65,000 subnets at that end site, each of which can support 18 quintillion hosts. So lots of addresses. It's actually pretty easy to get IPv6 addresses provisioned at this point. The bigger trick is getting them routed, and hopefully we kind of covered that already.
Larissa Shapiro, ISC, and I just wanted to put my DHCP product manager hat on and say that we are trying to make our DHCP v6 deployment better, and we have a need to prioritize all the different things that we could do to make it better. So if you, any of you in the room, have ideas about which things are most particularly difficult for you about it, tell me. Either today you can find me, or you can just send me email. I'm larissas@isc.org. I would love it, because there's too many for us to fix at one time with our little tiny group of engineers. So.
Yeah, and thank you for that. And unfortunately, the biggest problem that I see with DHCP 6 is that the IETF needs to pull their head out of their and let us put routing information in as an optional field.
Yes, this is a big problem, and it's one that we're...
You can't solve it till the IETF does, at least not in a useful, compatible manner.
That's the thing. We could just go ahead, which actually is my current theory, but it won't really solve the problem.
Should we just implement the
draft spec? Yes.
The problem is that puts you on the same playing field with a small software company in Redmond, Washington. Let's just ignore the RFC and do what we think is right. Prototyping. Anyway, I have some suggestions on how to do it if you do decide to move forward.
Okay, I'm listening.
So let's talk offline. Yes.
Yeah. Thank you. What's your opinion about what's the best way to, if you got a laptop, and you're in a kind of non-named hotel that only provides your IPv4, how to set up the tunnel? Is that doing SSH? Is that something else, because you have a dynamic endpoint, you're behind now.
Well, so
obviously.
So If you're stuck behind NAT, there aren't good answers, unfortunately. A lot of hotels actually do give you the option of, please give me a public address. So and they're the ones I usually tend to stay in. And in those cases, I'll opt for the public address, and then I'll just use a standard 6-4 tunnel or 6-4 tunnel, and everything is happy. If you use the 6XS tunnel broker or the GoGo tunnel broker, they both actually do have tunnel clients that use UDP and will do NAT traversal, and it's a real, real hackish solution, and the performance isn't great, and often your packets end up going halfway around the globe and back before they go anywhere useful. But other than those little deficiencies, they do actually sort of work. Mostly, I frankly give up on V6 in hotels and complain to the hotel about their internet being broken. Yep.
But they don't understand that, so you got
they do when I get through complaining.
Okay.
It's all a matter of how hard you're willing to complain.
Sure.
If you want to comment, come to the mic, because we're streaming this session. But I think we're basically out of time, so thank you very much.
Thank you.